Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Americans have long believed that the United States was the world's most innovative nation. However, according to our guests for this first hour of the show, other nations around the world are beginning to catch up. We'll talk today in this first hour with John Keogh, and he is the author of a recently published book that says it all in the title, that is Innovation Nation, the subtitle, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. The book is recently published by the Free Press. He says that innovation is fast becoming a guiding force for public policy in one country after another, but not ours. The book advocates making changes in a number of areas in education, in the way that we recruit talent, and in invest by government. And he says what's at stake is nothing less than our future prosperity and security. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He taught a popular course on the subject of innovation at the Harvard Business School for 14 years. He also served as visiting professor at the MIT Media Lab and as distinguished visiting professor of innovation at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. In addition, he is the founder of Keogh & Company, his own company that advises Fortune 500 business leaders as well as government leaders from around the world. He is today in Chicago, where he is taking part in the second annual conference on innovation that's sponsored by the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. They have titled the conference Innovate Now, and the idea is to take a regional perspective to the subject. So if you're interested in the book, you can head out and take a look at it. And of course, here this morning as we talk, questions are welcome too. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And by the way, if you go looking for his book, the spelling on his last name is K-A-O. Mr. Keogh, hello.
David, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Given your very varied background, and I did not mention the fact that you've been a musician and you'd been in film and theater production, and that your academic training ranges from philosophy to psychiatry to business, how is it that you decided that you wanted to make innovation the thing that was going to be your thing?
Well, if I put a string through all of these beads, whether, as you pointed out, I was involved in producing film or collaborating in music or starting companies or doing academic projects, the common theme throughout all of it was working with talented people, creating new ideas, getting resources, and making something new and hopefully very valuable happen. And that's the dictionary definition of innovation. So it comes in many different forms, but the underlying principles are pretty similar.
Hmm. And your central arguments, as I mentioned here, is that while the United States continues to be engaged in innovation, other countries are certainly catching up, and a lot of that apparently has to do with the fact that in those countries, the government has decided that this is going to be important, that they are putting energy and resources into that. And in fact, other countries have an innovation policy, but we don't.
Well, that's right. I'm not one to say that government has all the answers or that top-down is best, but the kind of innovation that I'm particularly interested in is large-scale national initiatives. You know, if you want next-generation genomics research, or if you want personalized medicine or nanotechnology and nanomolecular materials or new approaches to national security, you know, what have you. These are not the kind of initiatives that a couple of entrepreneurs can sit around over a cup of coffee and decide are interesting and cause the whole revolution to happen. It takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of talent, it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of foresight to understand the difference between near-term, quick-fix kind of applications of creativity and the long-term waves of innovation that you have to invest in very early. So, you know, government's role, I think, in general, whether it's in the U.S. or in countries like Finland or Singapore or even China, is very much about framing the issue of why innovation is important, in making investments, governing policies around education, you know, setting the game board so that the talented people can bubble up the innovative ideas.
A little earlier this month, a lot of people were marking the 50th anniversary of the launch of Sputnik, the Soviet satellite. The Soviets were the first to do this, put a satellite in orbit around the United States. And one of the results here in the United States was, it was the, if you'll pardon, everyone will pardon the cliche, it was the proverbial wake-up call. A lot of people here in the United States said, what we need to do is make a greater investment in scientific research. We need to improve education here in the United States, particularly in things like math and science. And as a result, there was indeed a big change and a lot of resources put into those things. And here you're, in a sense, invoking that spirit. Would you say that that was really the last time that the United States felt that kind of urgency to move in this kind of direction, to make these kind of improvements and to put resources into research and into education?
Absolutely. You know, 1957 was a seismic event for the United States. October 4th, 1957 is the day that the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, which was a 184-pound satellite with a little beeping noise. It didn't, you know, from the benefit of hindsight, it didn't, might not have seemed like such a big deal, but those of us that remember back to Sputnik remember that the world went from being two-dimensional to three-dimensional because we all looked up for the first time at the sky, at this object that had been created by the Soviets. And it's hard to overstate the anxiety and the trauma, in a way, that people experienced at that time. I mean, Lyndon Johnson prowled around the government talking about how this was the moral equivalent of Pearl Harbor, and people talked about it in terms of the shot heard around the world at Lexington and Concord. And so, you know, whether we were behind or not in science and education and other fields, we embraced a national campaign to boost our innovation capabilities. We had a wise president, Dwight Eisenhower, who gave the American people a story around innovation and around the significance of Sputnik. And the message was basically, this is a problem, it is a challenge, but we can deal with it. And our future does lie in space. And most specifically, our future lies in the peaceful uses of space. He commissioned a national science advisor. NASA was started. DARPA was started. The National Defense Education Act was started that ultimately influenced close to 2 million careers by providing education support, and not just in obvious areas like physical science and math, but also cultural studies and liberal arts, all of which were seen as contributing to a greater national security and national strength. Now, if you fast forward 50 years to today, I would argue that the gap between where we could be and where we are is quite large, but we don't seem to be worried about it. We are rather complacent. And so in the book, I describe the current situation as kind of a silent Sputnik. You know, we don't have an obvious pain point. It's not like something was hurled into the sky that demonstrated disruptive innovation that might be a threat to our national security. And so even though people might intellectually say, oh, yes, innovation is very important, they have not connected it to the national narrative and need for security, for watering the roots of our future prosperity. And, you know, they're just not as worried about it as I think we all need to be. The book was written to be a wake-up call, because I think we have a serious problem, and if we don't address it, we're going to suffer some serious consequences.
Well, just very quickly, let me again introduce the guest, John Kao, and his last name spelled K-A-O, and the book is Innovation Nation. It's just out recently. It's published by Free Press, so if you'd like to take a look at it, you can go down to the bookstore. And again, questions and comments here are welcome, as always. If you'd like to call in, join the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. In the book, you note that, 60 years ago, at the end of World War II, the United States was definitely the top in terms of innovation. And still today, the United States is home to some of the biggest, most important centers of innovation in the world still. There's no country that's quite at our level. However, what you're suggesting is that there are a number of other countries that are rapidly catching up. Where in the world do you think the pace of innovation now is is hottest and would be a place that, in terms of innovation, you would say would be, say, positioned to equal or perhaps rival the United States?
Well, I think in the immediate landscape, you have to consider some very smart little countries like Singapore and Finland. Singapore, for example, which is a country of 4.5 million people, now has a standard of living that rivals countries in Europe. It's at the OECD level of economic development. I'll just give you one anecdote from Singapore. They've targeted biological sciences, life sciences, as a national priority, one of three, actually, and are funding it very generously to the point where they have this research center called the Biopolis. That's a city within a city for medical research. The plan at the Biopolis is to have 10,000 PhD scientists within the next 15 years, half of which will be cultivated from local talent, sent abroad to study, and half of which will be imported from places, by the way, like the United States. And 10,000 research scientists is more research scientists than we have at NIH, at the National Institutes of Health in Washington. So it's an example of how a country with a small population can fight way above its weight in playing the global innovation game if they have the national will and the budget and the intention to do so. But the other example at the other end of the spectrum would be China. You know, China now produces more PhDs in science and engineering than the United States by a big margin, and it's an accelerating gap. And again, I don't want to invoke a Cold War notion that we're now in some intellectual arms race with the rest of the world. I think that a world in which many countries know how to innovate is ultimately a better world. What I object to is our kind of taking our foot off the gas. And to return to China, though, if you look at their ability to produce scientific research, patents, scientific articles, it's accelerating to the point where a larger and larger share of scientific discovery is going to come from countries outside of the U.S. Now, that's inevitable. You know, after World War II, we were the only act in town. You know, we produced half of the world's industrial output. We had all of the great universities still standing. Everyone wanted to come here to glide past the Statue of Liberty and become Americans and to share in the American dream. I think the current situation is that the American dream has become the global dream, and many countries now have entrepreneurs and venture capital and great universities and a desire to succeed in business and scientific research. And so, you know, our job is both to understand our position in a world that has changed dramatically, a world, by the way, that has changed dramatically beyond the perspective of many, if not the majority, of my fellow citizens to really, you know, comprehend, because the changes are so dramatic. And on the other hand, what we need to do is to really take stock of our own situation and to do better.
Well, given the fact that the kind of technologies that we talk about that are very important now are, in a sense, globally distributed,
yes,
and the fact that it's also very easy for money to move around and for talent to move around, can we really assume that any one country can ever again have the kind of dominance that the United States once had and maybe is just clinging on to?
Well, I think dominance may also be language from a certain era of global competition where one country had to be on top. I think that America is still in the leadership position. You know, so I don't want people out there to think that the book that I wrote is kind of a Chicken Little book that says the sky is falling in. We have a big population of talented people. We have 38 of the top universities in the world, according to international rankings. We spend roughly 50% of all the money that's spent worldwide for research and development. My concern about the United States is that we're underperforming relative to where we could be, and that with the erosion of certain pillars of our innovation society that have to do with public education and policies towards research and national priorities, we're in danger of having our leadership position erode to the point that we will not be able to have the influence and the consequential influence on the world in terms of fueling improvement in a lot of humanity through innovation that we could. And if we sacrifice that leadership position, I think that will be a great shame for everyone worldwide, because America is still a unique platform for innovation. You know, we have a culture that celebrates exploration and that insulates brave risk takers from the downside consequences of failure. You know, we're a nation of prudent risk takers. We're free, we're diverse, we try things out. You know, this is a great crucible for new ideas. And this is our secret sauce. You know, other countries may have national funds and smart tax policies with regard to innovation, but they don't have our culture. They may have imported bits of it, or, you know, have people who understand how to behave in terms of that culture, but we live in it every day. But what we don't seem to have right now are smart policies with regard to funding research and education and other fundamentals, other building blocks of an innovation society that I think over time are really going to cause a serious concern.
Mm-hmm. I think it might be interesting for people to hear you talk a little bit more about Finland. And I would think earlier when I asked this question about, well, where are those countries where the pace of innovation is really strong and are those that are creeping up on and in a position to challenge the United States? And that was one of the places that you mentioned. And I'm sure that there were a lot of people who would say, Finland? But in fact, you have to. One thing you certainly, maybe people may or may not know, is that Finland happens to be the home of the world's largest manufacturer of cell phones, Nokia. And it's almost like a, I'm not sure what else is going in Finland, but it's almost like a one company country. I don't know how many Finns actually work for Nokia, but I'm sure that a lot of people do.
Nokia is certainly a big piece of the Finnish GDP. There's no doubt about it. But Finland is interesting because, as you say, it seems like an unlikely candidate for being a world leader in anything, just a little obscure. But Finland actually was rated the number one competitive economy by the World Economic Forum last year, number one in the world. And not coincidentally, the ratings of their students in areas like math, education, performance in math, is also number one, which gives you a really clear sense of the linkage between the cultivation of homegrown talent, i.e., you know, via education, and competitiveness. I mean, we spend more money per capita in the United States for education than any other country in the world. And yet, if you look at the standardized tests on math performance, for instance, we're not number one or number five or number 10 or number 15. We're number 24th worldwide. You know, our performance in terms of science is similarly dismal. And there are many, many reasons for this, all of which are remediable, but we don't seem to be doing anything about it. Meanwhile, you have Finland. And, you know, clearly there are advantages from being a small, compact society. You know, Finland's, like Singapore, is a compact society with, you know, a lot of homogeneity, so it's easy to get cooperation. If we look at their model, they've created essentially an ecosystem for innovation. They have government, they have university, they have private sector, they have venture funds, and everyone talks to everyone else, so that whether it's new innovations in telecommunications or forestry, which is, you know, obviously a traditional skill set of Finland, they're seems to be an ability to put minds and resources to work very rapidly and in a very focused way on innovation agendas that are going to pay off both socially and economically. And, you know, we rely on the free market to do this work, and I think that to a certain extent is justified. I mean, that's the nature of our American system. But unfortunately, remedying issues like our education system or reordering our research priorities can't come through the free market. You know, if President Kennedy had said, you know, I understand that it's possible to travel to the moon, let's put it out and let the free market figure out how we should do this, at least in the 60s, you know, we wouldn't have gotten there in less than 10 years. I mean, obviously now there are space entrepreneurs, and that's a great thing, but that's layering upon the wisdom of our government leaders to create kind of the game board on which the entrepreneurs can play.
Mm-hmm. You certainly point to something that I think concerns a lot of people and has been for some time, and that is the weakness of particularly elementary and secondary education here in the United States. I think that people still seem to think that higher education is in pretty good shape. At least it seems to attract a lot of people to do graduate work from around the world, but that we really have a significant problem with our elementary and high schools. Is there something specific that you have in mind or something that other countries do other than perhaps just making it more rigorous, having kids spend more time in the classroom or making it clear that you're expecting higher performance of them? I mean, what really do you think makes the difference between, say, high school in Finland and high school in the United States?
I think the key difference is how the system treats teachers and how it develops teachers. So in Finland, teaching is a very socially prestigious profession. People go to higher institutions of higher education to get certified in teaching. When a teaching position opens up in Finland, typically there are multiple applicants. People actually compete to fill vacant slots. And teachers are paid extremely well relative to how they're paid in the U.S. So all of those, and obviously teachers have career paths. They can have professional development activities. And I know these things are done to some extent in the U.S. as well, but I think the issue for us here is that what we value gets attended to. And it seems to me that our valuing of education has, maybe at an intellectual level, remained the same, but at a practical level has started to deteriorate. And, you know, I think the problems in our education system are not going to be solved just by more of X, Y, or Z. You know, more homework or more money spent on textbooks and whatever, you know, may produce some incremental gains, but they're not going to transform the education enterprise. And I think that's really what's at stake. There's a reason why, in my home city of San Francisco, one-third of high school-age kids did not graduate from high school last year, right? And that's an alarming statistic, because when you think about it, you wonder, what are these kids going to do? How are they going to create careers for themselves if they're kind of opting out very early in the game? You know, there are only a limited number of rental property management and massage therapy jobs that are available in society, and those don't tend to lead to interesting careers anyway. And it's harder and harder to get back on the career track. So, you know, I know that in the United States, at the top of the talent pyramid, things are fine. You know, we have a society that makes iPhones and develops Facebook and that has 38 of the top 50 universities worldwide. So you could say we have a lot of innovation going on, and you wouldn't be wrong. But the thing that most concerns me is the body politic. You know, if we stop educating our kids in science and math, and if a generation that loves technology but can't be bothered to learn how to, what the principles are behind it, and if our math and science activities are increasingly outsourced to people from abroad who, by the way, are also increasingly inclined to come here for a great MIT or, you know, Berkeley education, but then are much more inclined to go home rather than settle in the United States and become Americans and contribute to the national welfare here, then the engines of innovation, which translate into the engines of wealth creation and security, are going to be located abroad. And this is not the kind of change that we could peg at a certain moment in time. I mean, this is another one of these silent Sputnik phenomena where, while we are all probably, you know, we'd all agree that things could be a lot better. Many, if not the majority of us, are somewhat anxious about it. There isn't some inciting incident that makes us say, darn it, we've got to get this education business in order. You know, we need an education president. We need a national education policy. We've got to resolve this issue of not paying teachers enough and not training them enough and not having, by the way, qualified certified teachers teach science and math, which is a big reason why our kids aren't interested in it, because if they don't have specialist teachers in these fields, they're not going to get inspired. I mean, science should be the easiest topic to teach to get kids excited, because you get to do a lot of cool stuff. But if you never got trained in science, don't care about it that much, but were made to teach it by the system, as is the case with too many schools, you're going to wind up passing on your indifference to science to your students. And I think we're kind of systematically disinvesting in our capabilities for these scientific and technical fields, while many other countries are systematically investing in them. And that's, I think, the gap that we're looking at. Mm.
We're at our midpoint. I have a caller we'll get right to, but for anybody else who might have just tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest, John Cale. He has been thinking about, talking about, writing about innovation for a long time. He taught a popular course on the subject at the Harvard Business School for 14 years. He has also been visiting professor at the MIT Media Lab and distinguished visiting professor of innovation at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's the founder of Cale and Company. It's a company that advises top-tier Fortune 500 business leaders as well as government leaders from around the world. He is the author of the book Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do to Get It Back. It's been recently published by the Free Press, so you can find that in the bookstore. His name, by the way, if you go looking for the book, his last name is spelled K-A-O. Right at the moment, he is in Chicago to take part in the second annual conference on innovation sponsored by the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. They're titling it Innovate Now, and the idea is to try to take a regional perspective to the subject of innovation. So if you're interested in the book, you can go out and look for it, and if you'd like to be a part of this conversation, you can do that too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. I'm really strongly agree with your notion of culture as an integral part of innovation, and the educational aspect of this is the idea of teaching math and science is very important, knowing fundamentals, but I have a background in art history, a doctorate, and I hold three patents you'd call them in the engineering field. Just out of curiosity, I was just interested in things like that as a sideline. But what I've always discovered is that when you want to sell a product, it's more of a marketing deal. And I did run an advertising company for a while and did that as a sideline for making money. But I think you're right about this. But I really want to say that you should reinforce the notion of culture as an enhancer or a bed for innovation, because the United States, following Western Europe, Europe in the 19th century and the early 20th century, the United States was very open and very, you know, eclectic. They borrowed from everybody, took everything, and so that's why we became what we became. And so when you're at this, we're sort of an apex now, and I agree with your notion that we're declining, but also the stimuli could be more of a reward for innovation versus all of this harassment. I did have a product years ago that took me 3 years to get it in market. It did modestly successful, and then the market changed, so it just disappeared.
You said a couple of things that I'd like to underline as well. First of all, I think the kind of career path that you've had that spans disciplines, and certainly the kind of career path that I've had, or non-career path, mm-hmm. would be very hard in other societies. But I think there's a way in which in America there's a celebration of diversity and a kind of a can-do, go-try-that point of view. And you and I both seem to be illustrations of that. The other point is about culture, and I want to expand the aperture a bit. I've been spending a lot of time so far in the interview talking about science and math, but mm-hmm. I think that innovation equally is fed by the fields of design and also the arts, and innovation comes from cultural intelligence. It comes from the kind of business intelligence that develops new business models. Business model innovation is just as important as technology innovation. And in fact, the government of Singapore invests a lot of money in public art because they see that as enabling a culture of innovation in the scientific and technical institutions that they've created. So science and math may be a hot spot because if you don't have that, you probably can't run the race. But if you don't invest in these other areas, you're not going to have much either.
Oh, and I agree. I want to add one thing before I hang up. I agree with your premise, and I think it's very important that we look at things in a totality, such as like giving people at universities, not just engineers, a mathematics, science, regimented background, but also giving them a more of a liberal arts background where you think beyond your field so you become more in design-oriented. And that's a very crucial thing. But also, I wanted to add one thing about the services industry, which the United States seems to lead in, and maybe Britain, where they design method of, you know, function of organizations. You know, this university here has, you know, business schools, and you design financial instruments and things like that. And I know you started this transition from product, where you, you know, your iPod, which is a design and an engineering feat, but more of a design feat, to a how do you sell somebody something methodology thing, and patents are now even in copyrighted material, which I understand a lot of that too. But this is a very, very important subject because I think, in a sense, globalization, too, sort of puts us all in the same game. We're all sort of interconnected, and like the environment in China is our deal just as much as our environment is their deal. So, but thank you. You sound really interesting. I'll look for your book.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We were talking earlier about the fact that there are a lot of people who come from outside of the United States who come here to study in colleges and universities. And in fact, here in your book, you note that foreign students now represent something like 17% of all of the grad students into the United States. And more to the point here, as you write, half of all grad students in engineering and 40% in the physical sciences. One of the things that you argue for here is that we should see what we can do to persuade some of these people who come from outside of the United States to study and might be otherwise inclined then to go home, back to their homes, and live and work there, see what we can do to persuade some of them to settle in the United States so that we can hold on to the skills and talent that they have.
Well, the statistics on the role of immigrants in our innovation society cannot be overstated as well. There's a recent study that shows that approximately a third or more of the founders of high-tech companies in Silicon Valley were born abroad. You know, foreign-born faculty are disproportionately engaged in teaching science and engineering in the United States, and foreign-born students are a disproportionate number of the participants in those programs. So in the old days, we didn't have a marketing problem because everyone wanted to come here because we were the only offering and we were a very good one. But now you're not only seeing students from India decide to go back to Bangalore because actually the quality of life there is better, or students from China wanting to go back to Shanghai because the quality of life is pretty good there now. But you're also seeing talented Americans in increasing numbers emigrating to get jobs in those places as well. I mean, the head of the Biopolis, which I referenced earlier, referred to his role, tongue-in-cheek, I might add. He's a good guy, but tongue-in-cheek, as a serial kidnapper. And Biopolis has peeled off the head of the National Cancer Institute in Washington and the dean of the University of San Diego School of Medicine and many top-level scientists to go work in Singapore because, frankly, the working conditions there are better than they are here. So I think that our drain of talent is both a combination of people who would have stayed here but are now leaving. And, by the way, that's also because our public image in the world is less good than it was maybe 6 or 7 years ago. We are harder to deal with as a country if you're a foreigner. It's harder to get a visa. It's harder to come into the United States. So, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, gee, if it's so hard, why bother? There's also the phenomenon, by the way, of the globalization of higher education. So places like MIT and Wharton now, I think, correctly see themselves as being global brands. And MIT just announced, by the way, that it's opening a campus in Singapore. So, you know, if you live in Asia, for instance, you don't have to come to Cambridge, Massachusetts anymore to get an MIT-level education. You can go to Singapore, bypassing the American experience completely. And if you then begin to compound that with what I don't think we could call a brain drain yet, because there's not enough evidence to suggest that, but which in time could become a brain drain out of the U.S. as more of our young people begin to explore opportunities that are created by this global economy, that will be a particularly distressing kind of double whammy in the talent department.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked earlier about the fact that here, you know, in the United States, historically, we've had a lot of faith in the market and in that doing what it has to do, and certainly in Washington among particular parties, we have a great faith in the market and a reluctance to get government directly involved. Is this a case now, going back here to kind of the point where we started, where you think that the government really should actually have an innovation policy, that it shouldn't just be something where we say, well, we leave this to private companies and to the market to do, that we, the government, we don't really need to do anything to stimulate that. They'll just do it all. Do we actually need to have a kind of deliberate government policy on innovation?
So this is a very important question, and it relates to the what are we going to do about this problem topic. I'm not, as I said earlier, an advocate of top-down, gold-plated solutions, and I don't believe government has all the answers. But on the other hand, I don't believe that we can solve the challenges we face with this innovation problem we have just by the free market and the bubbling up of the ideas of smart people. So I think that, in a way, there's a bit of a false dichotomy of, are we going to just be free market people or are we going to be top-down government people? I think we have to have a blend now, and I think that, I refer to this in the book as the helping hand, not the invisible hand, because everyone has a role to play. So, if you think about what government does, government collects taxes, they make investments, hopefully wise ones, they regulate education, they fund research, they set standards of practice, they protect intellectual property. They may support research through fiscal means like tax credits. They set trade policies. They act as a source of demand for innovators by buying their discoveries for use in the military or in healthcare and so forth and so on. So, like it or not, government at the federal as well as the state and local level have a big role in the innovation ecosystem already, and that's not going to change. On the other hand, I firmly believe that innovation comes when the right game board encourages lots and lots of talented people to go after the thing that they're most passionate about, but on a game board that's set up for success, right? Mm. So I do think, and I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about what we need to do as a country, and I do think we need a national plan for innovation. It's not a plan as in a blueprint that should be followed slavishly, but rather a framework for beginning to have a national conversation about what we should do. The first thing that we have to do, it seems to me, is we have to accept and recognize as a country that we have a problem in this area. And I think we're still consumed by a certain amount of complacency and denial. We're acting a bit, in my view, like the third generation wealthy. The greatest generation made it, and their kids built it, and now we're living off of the assets that in a sense, we've inherited. So, the question about what we need to do, I think, first of all, stems from a recognition that we have a problem. And by the way, a sophisticated recognition that doesn't just say, okay, the fix for innovation is to have more homework in schools, because you couldn't disagree with that, but the problem is a lot more complex than that, and I've tried to paint a picture of that. The second thing we need at a societal level is we need stewardship of this innovation agenda. And I believe that we actually need to elect somebody into the office of president who understands this problem, because if there isn't recognition at the top, people throughout government who want to do something about this will not have the aegis to do it. So there's been a lot of call for an energy president or an education president, but I believe we need an innovation president. We need somebody who understands this issue and then who can create stewardship and accountability for the issue within government and catalyze the right kind of public and private partnerships to actually create this national innovation strategy for our country. Then underneath that, there are piles of initiatives that need to be looked at in the course of developing this plan. Obviously, there's a whole telephone book-sized set of issues around public education. There are things that we should be doing in terms of fiscal policy to support research. I think we need to take a lot of the impediments to research away from our scientists. I think we need to restore the integrity of basic science and long-term scientific horizons. I think we need to get our national house in order with regard to our spending priorities. Countries are like companies, invest in the future when they have extra money to do that. We're spending money a hand over fist on things like servicing our national debt and trying to bring our sometimes crumbling public infrastructure back up to some decent standard. You know, the American Society of Civil Engineers estimated that it would take $1.3 trillion just to bring our bridges and roads and other public infrastructure up to an acceptable level, right? And if you couple that with, you know, the Congressional Budget Office's estimate today that the wars we're involved in might cost as much as $2.4 trillion, you know, you add all these things together, it's a lot of money. The Singapore Biopolis cost $2 billion so far. The national debt service on our national debt is $2 billion a day. So, you know, in a way, we're spending a biopolis worth of money every day as a country, which could be used for investment, but is simply going into consumption or into social priorities, which I think we all need to sit back and take a look at.
Hmm. Well, one basic bottom line question: do you think that, and you know, this we can't ignore the fact that there are a lot of demands on the budget, but do you think that really the United States government, the federal government, should be investing more money in research?
Absolutely. You can never. Well, obviously, you want to be prudent about these investments, but I think there's been a systematic disinvestment in basic research, which is the long-term, horizon-oriented research, as opposed to the near-term tactical stuff, which is really the roots of innovation on a long-term basis. So, you know, I think we've, in this country, gotten much more focused on near-term instrumental outcomes, and that's reflected in the way we fund research. And it's, by the way, not just government funding, but also obviously, private sector, you know, corporate funding as well. So I think we need to spend more money on research, and I think we need to spend money in a very intelligent way on research with the right balance between long-term and short-term. And I also think that, you know, we need to do this in the context of having a refreshed view of what the purpose of our country is. You know, our country has historically seen itself as a leader in the world and a force for good, and as having an idea of the good life so powerful that it could be exported around the world. And I think that a lot of people are not buying into that the way they have historically for all kinds of reasons. The opportunity we have to regenerate our national innovation engine and to get better at doing this as a society offers us a tremendous opportunity to focus those energies on the dozen or so wicked problems that affect all of humanity, whether they're in the biological sciences or in, think about all the problems we have now in terms of environment and sustainability, energy, infectious disease, education, et cetera, et cetera. And we should be in the addressing big challenges through innovation business. That should, you know, that is historically been who we are. That can be reinvented for the 21st century. You know, it used to be said that what is good for America is good for the world. And in the book, I talk some about how we have an opportunity and really a responsibility to turn that around and say, what's good for the world is good for America. We are the only country in the world that has the critical mass, the culture, the money, the talent, the infrastructure to be able to address these wicked problems. And it doesn't take lots of money. You know, it costs a lot less than fighting a war or doing other kinds of things to make the smart investments in innovation. But we've got to start, because this is not a static race. You know, I mean, a lot of people are doing a lot of things worldwide, and every day that we don't move forward, we're essentially falling behind.
Yeah, I think that maybe we have come to accept the notion that private corporations are only going to spend money on research if they think that they're going to get a payback and over a relatively short time horizon, and that if we then must turn to the federal government for funding of pure science research that may or may not yield any practical benefits anytime soon. Do you think that someone needs to say to private corporations that we actually would expect them to be spending some more money on research that doesn't necessarily guarantee some kind of short-term payback?
Well, I think there's a general question of what we say to companies that started in the U.S. but no longer necessarily see themselves as being American companies. I mean, there's a more basic issue, which is, You know, for instance, Intel has operations around the world. I interviewed Craig Barrett, the chairman of Intel, and he told me that locating a plant in India was a $1 billion positive net present value decision. In other words, they could save $1 billion by locating an identical plant in India as opposed to the U.S. And, you know, he allowed that Intel might not even really see itself as being an American company these days. Well, in that situation, trying to figure out how to get companies to play in the game of strengthening America's capabilities is tricky. But there are historical precedents for this. You know, when we thought in the 80s that we were falling way behind in the semiconductor area, computer chip area, which we, by the way, created, right? I mean, all the technology was invented in the U.S. There were some interesting consortia that were created. One was Semitech, which had plenty of government engagement, but which brought all of the big companies in the semiconductor business together. And they crafted a strategy for this industry, which wasn't top-down government, but was, you know, government and private sector, top-down and bottom-up. And a number of priorities were identified for developmental research. And the crisis passed, and actually the program was so successful that Semitech voluntarily disbanded because the moment of peril, so to speak, in terms of our competitiveness in that area had passed. And, you know, I can easily see that kind of a model adapted for current circumstances being applied to engage companies in essentially consortia, innovation consortia, that could have multiple benefits. You know, one of the things we have to be concerned about in this country, which is why I'm so glad we're having this Chicagoland discussion about innovation at a regional level in this four-state area, is that innovation in America shouldn't just be thought of as Silicon Valley and, you know, Route 128 and Austin and a couple of other places. You know, innovation in this country needs to be thought of as a national network of centers of excellence, of which great universities are obvious hotspots for concentrating those kinds of resources. So if you have cities that have traditionally been good in an industry but have faced disruption because of global competition, but there's talent and there's a university and there could be new funding mechanisms and new ways of bringing public and private players to the table, all of a sudden you have a way of replicating that national innovation strategy at a state and regional and city local level. And that's when I think you get real power. I mean, obviously people inside the Beltway in Washington have limited visibility on what goes on in Indiana or what goes on in a part of Indiana or what goes on in a local neighborhood. But that's fine because we all have a role to play. I mean, I argue that we all, every one of us as citizens, have a responsibility to build Innovation Nation because it really starts with us, you know, with our attitudes towards how we educate our children and the choices we make in terms of community engagement, how we manage our companies, and, you know, how we see ourselves in this kind of global innovation-driven world and, you know, what the choices are.
We just have a couple of minutes left, I'm sorry to say, and several callers, so we don't believe we'll be able to get them all. We'll try to get at least one. The next person in line is in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted some comment on the idea that large corporations often resist and are an impediment to innovation. You take the American automotive industry, and it had a dominant share, but then didn't use that share to push for innovation, but to stifle it. And so then you got Japan, Germany, Korea coming into the marketplace with innovation and sort of taking over the market. Same thing with telecoms. They are stifling a lot of the competition in terms of like DSL and high-speed internet access, so that even DSL in this country is a lot slower than it is in places like Korea.
And I can give you, John, about a minute to respond,
sure.
Unfortunately, because we, as I said,
understand.
We're
well,
not
I'll be
done.
I'll be succinct. Yeah. First of all, I agree with the idea that big companies sometimes have a lot of innovation problems. Actually, in the book, and I hope people will appreciate this is somewhat tongue in cheek, I refer to the U.S. in a sense as kind of the U.S. car manufacturer equivalent on a worldwide basis. I mean, the bigger you get, the more established you get, the more successful you get, the more vulnerable you are to becoming complacent. And I think that innovation then comes up from the insurgents, whether they're companies or countries, with little downside and a hunger to succeed. So the trick for the United States, just like the mature companies you talked about, is how do we actually actively manage innovation so that we can progress and move forward to our desired future? That's our big challenge.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. My apologies to the callers that we can't take, but we've simply here at the end of the time. If you're interested in reading more from our guest, you can look for the book which he has authored. The title is Innovation Nation. It's recently published by the Free Press. Our guest, John Kao, and his last name spelled K-A-O, has taught at the Harvard Business School, also the MIT Media Lab. He's been distinguished visiting professor of innovation at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and in addition, he is the founder of Kao & Company that advises a lot of big company leaders as well as government leaders around the world. And as we mentioned, he is today in Chicago. He's taking part in the second annual conference on innovation sponsored by the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Kao, thanks very much.
Thank you.